Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, last year's derailment of a Lynx Blue Line train is shaking things up. Concerns over transparency and calls for accountability surface, and now an outside investigation will soon get underway. In A Tale of Two Cities, Huntersville rejects more development at Brookdale Village, and Charlotte okays it at South Park. We follow up on stonewalling at CMS over an alleged sexual assault of a five-year-old and get the latest on the quest for answers. And we look at the debate over reading in Fort Mill. Plus, Charlotte loses two more legends, one from politics and government, the other from industry and philanthropy, Parks Helms and Dale Halton. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE education reporter Ann Doss Helms. Katie Peralta Soloff is an editor at Axios Charlotte. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Welcome to you all. Thank you for being here.
Morning.
Where to begin? As we have discussed, a Lynx Blue Line train derailed last May, and until about 2 weeks ago, no one, not even the interim CEO at CATS, Brent Cagle, knew anything about it. After a year of really bad publicity over various troubles at CATS, action is now being taken. The Metropolitan Transit Commission met on Wednesday night and voted unanimously to hire an outside consultant to investigate what happened. Given what appears to be either gross negligence or gross incompetence, was this really their only choice? Joe.
I don't know if it was the only choice, and I've heard from some people who are like, you know, I really wish our solution wasn't hiring another consultant to tell us what's wrong, but clearly they need to get everything out into the open because this spigot keeps dripping.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. When they do this, when they hire this alleged forensic consultant to find out what happens, to get things out in the open, will they be out in the open or will they just keep it to themselves?
I have confidence that Brent Cagle will bring it out into the open because he has proven that he is just shoving everything into the public view as soon as, or for the most part, as soon as he learns it.
To the extent that he is allowed to, and that's a big if, because let's not forget, Brent Cagle has bosses. And I agree with Joe that Brent himself has been extraordinarily upfront. I mean, talk about the guy at the world's worst job right now in Charlotte, right? Like, here, go to this dumpster fire, get in the dumpster fire and extinguish it from inside. I mean, it's really what it feels like, right?
Here's this cup of water.
that's exactly right. But let's not forget, and let's drill down early. I know we're going to talk about the mayor here in a second, but the mayor issued a statement a couple days ago, I think on Tuesday. I don't know what day it is today. I think it's Friday because we're on the roundup. But the mayor issued a very lengthy and detailed statement earlier this week in which she vowed transparency, and we're going to hold her to that. I know everyone on this show is going to hold her to that, and that's what the citizens of Charlotte deserve.
Yeah, and she said that because NCDOT has said this derailment was due to delayed maintenance, and the CATS response to it had been, this is a quote, unclear, insufficient, and not acceptable. That's NCDOT. They ordered some of the trains removed from service until they could be repaired. All 42 cars in the Lynx system need the same repair to the tune of millions of dollars. And in the interim, trains have been reduced to 35 miles per hour, none of which we knew until 2 weeks ago. But the real problem here is communication and transparency within the CATS organization and among the CATS organization and the two bodies it reports to, the City of Charlotte and the Metropolitan Transit Commission. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles chairs that commission. She, too, was in the dark about the derailment. But when I spoke with her on this program this week, she said the reporting structure is the problem. She compared it to when children play one parent off the other.
And you go to one and they say, go ask your mom. And then they say, go ask your dad. So you've got the council and the MTC that are working together in a way that's informative, but not necessarily deep enough. And we need to start looking at that. And those disclosed shortcomings were really unknown to both groups.
And when I asked about accountability, she blamed the reporting structure and called for it to change so that CATS leaders would clearly understand the structure.
We have changed a lot in the 24 years that we've had this agreement. So you know what, Mike? I think anyone that has touched this in a leadership role has some accountability. But if you don't know that other people don't know, what happens? And so in this case, our agreement, the way that we are structured as the MTC and the Charlotte City Council in this agreement has to be rethought. And I think that that's one of the first things that we ought to dive into is who's going to be accountable. And it can't be both the city of Charlotte and the MTC.
But Mecklenburg County Commissioner Lee Altman sits on the Transit Commission. She says the lack of having a transit authority had nothing to do with it.
There's no ambiguity that CATS' CEO directly reports to the city manager or his ACM. It cannot be said that anyone at CATS was unclear who they should report to and that this is the reason that all of these lapses occurred.
She's the one on commission that called for this investigation, and they voted unanimously to give her that. You were shaking your head all through the mayor's comments a moment ago. Nick, why?
I hear a complete and total lack of ownership of any problems and lack of accountability. And if you wonder why we have a culture within the city of Charlotte government that passes the buck and refuses to accept responsibility or accountability for anything, look at the top elected official in the city of Charlotte and look at the answer she just gave. Let's not forget, this is the same city council that was surprised when my colleague David Hodges last year told them in a news report that a private company was the company running the entirety of CATS bus operations, a company called RATP Dev. They didn't know about that. They didn't know. And if the people were surprised at what Mr. Cagle unveiled 2 weeks ago, they weren't paying attention to the last year of David Hodges' reporting that uncovered problem after problem after problem inside CATS. So if you're pretending that you didn't know, it's because you didn't want to know and you didn't ask any questions.
And interesting you should bring that up, because Mecklenburg County Commissioner, a member of the MTC, Lee Altman, also brought up the outlandish nature of the fact that public officials didn't know, and she only found out when a reporter told her.
It is very hard to start rebuilding trust when, as I sit here today, I would only have known about that extent of the problem before today because a reporter gave me the document. That is just unacceptable.
Oh, but it gets worse. Many have wondered, since this delayed maintenance and derailment has been hidden, what other problems might exist that we do not know about. And to top it off, interim CEO at CATS Brent Cagle says this may not be the end of the problems. It may just be the tip of the iceberg.
We should expect that there will be other things found.
Comforting words. This all seems like a snowball rolling downhill very fast. Are we making too much of this? I mean, how concerned should we be?
We're talking about grave safety issues here. I mean, grave safety issues. And again, remember, David had already uncovered massive safety issues with the buses last year. So it's not like no one had uncovered big safety problems within CATS that were being ignored and unreported. And the exact same problem with the bus division that we're now seeing with the Blue Line. And so we're talking about safety issues and a massive mismanagement, at the very least, of tax dollars. Those are two things that I think we can't focus on enough.
Yeah, I think having a good public transit system or not affects not just the people who rely on it every day. And that's huge if it's not. I mean, I remember her saying on your show something like, safety and reliability are our top priorities now. And I thought, now? I mean, that's really huge for those people. But again, taxpayers, it's an environmental issue. If we can't develop a good public transit system, we're more reliant on automobiles that have environmental implications.
So Davidson Mayor Rusty Knox is also a member of the Metropolitan Transit Commission. He and others have expressed shock at the lack of transparency from the former CATS leadership.
Deferred maintenance and preventive maintenance is just an outright failure. When you have the budget to do it and you don't do it, there's a problem.
Yeah, that's another thing that we haven't really talked about, the fact that the maintenance was not performed at all, evidently, for years. Former cats simply did not do it. And all this raises the question of accountability. It's a topic we spoke to the mayor about on Wednesday. And I brought that up specifically about cats, but also about what is apparently emerging as a pattern in local government at various different levels. And that is a situation where handsomely paid individuals depart, leaving major problems in their wake, and we, the taxpayers, never know the whole story or even why they left. Here's a part of that exchange. These three individuals who left cats were all making well into six figures of taxpayer dollars. Two of them left on their own, probably knowing they had problems that they didn't want to face. We don't know that, but that could be part of their reason for pursuing other employment opportunities. The third was told to leave, and we're not going to know why.
Well, I'm not an HR attorney, and I try not to practice anything in terms of what people say and do that I can't speak to, Mike. And I would say, does it really matter why they left now that we know that they're gone and now that we're beginning to work on some of the problems that we have to solve as a result of knowing that these actions have been taken?
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. So she said several times in that conversation that she wants to focus on the future and not look at the past or look back. And she said, and I quote, "Does it really matter?" Doesn't it? Joe?
This is something we were just talking about before the show started. You know, looking to the future, the city of Charlotte is poised to ask the federal government for potentially billions of dollars to build up our transit system, namely in the form of a Silver Line light rail. If our existing system doesn't work or is dysfunctional to the point where it's derailing and, you know, buses don't come on time and drivers are concerned for their own personal safety, how can anyone justify infusing that much money and raising taxes for taxpayers if what we have doesn't work already?
I can't believe that question, Mike. Does it really matter? Yes. Like,
it's the only thing. It is the only thing that matters. It was a shocking comment. I didn't even know how to respond to it. It's the only thing that matters.
Touched on how this compares to some of the CMS superintendents that have departed. We had two that there was an agreement that they would resign, and then we were going to say, you know, and the school board did exactly the same thing, you know, and that's in the past, let's look ahead. And then we had one who chose not to take that route, who said, nope, I have not done anything to be fired for cause. If you want me to go, you got to buy me out. And Ernest Winston was fired, and he was paid well over $500,000. And we got to see what the reports were.
Perhaps we could arrange for a tour of each of these people's homes to see how much dirt is under the carpets in these houses. Nick, your colleague at WBTV, David Hodges, reported this week that among MTC commissioners, there's this feeling, quote, that the faith they had in former CEO John Lewis was misplaced and that opinions were split on moving forward or looking back to hold people accountable. If you don't look back, how can you avoid repeating history?
Again, it continues to be the problem, certainly in city government and just about every government in this town, is that nobody wants to hold anyone accountable. Let's just move on. Let's not think. I mean, even we fired Ernest Winston for at part mishandling sex assaults in CMS, and we're still doing the same problems. We didn't learn to fix the problem. The same thing in the city. This happens all the time. It's unfortunately why David and I and lots of our colleagues have jobs to uncover this stuff, because it's just a revolving cycle.
And as we all know, the media is the problem. We'll have to take a break. We'll come back with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Katie Peralta-Soloff from Axios Charlotte, and Ann Doss-Helms from WFAE News, all part of our local news roundup this week. More to talk about with regard to cats and exactly where the former CEO went, that development and more when we continue. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins with Ann Doss-Helms from WFAE News, Katie Peralta-Soloff from Axios Charlotte, Nick Oxner from WBTV, and Joe Bruno from WSOC. TV. More to talk about with regard to the problems at Katz and Lynx. Katie, I think we should talk a little bit about the bus driver concerns from this past summer because they play into all of this. We had all those reports from bus drivers that kind of got ignored about safety issues. And now there have been not one, not two, but three train derailments. Two happened in the rail yard. One is the one where the biggest one is the one we've been talking about that happened along the Blue Line near Woodlawn Road. And WBTV's David Hodges reported that the train operator in that situation told dispatch that the cars were swaying erratically and that he didn't think that the train should be moved forward. But the rail operations office disagreed. Well, now we've heard about, and you've reported on, Katie, this culture of silence at Katz under former CEO John Lewis's leadership. How concerned should riders be about safety?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, I personally have not reported on the culture of silence. That was my colleague Alex Sands this week. But I think the thing, kind of backing up to the mayor's comment about, you know, the blame game and, you know, asking mommy or daddy for permission on any given issue, these are human lives. These are people who take the train and the bus every day to work, and they want to know that not only is their mode of transit reliable, but it's safe, and that's kind of the basic for transit, right? And we're learning about this particular derailment, like, weeks after a really catastrophic derailment up in Ohio. So when you say derailment, really the worst situation comes to mind. I think the fact that no one was injured in the last year is extremely lucky, because God knows what could have happened if not. And I would say moving forward, I would be concerned about safety. I mean, there, you know, Katz officials are saying, right now, the light rail is safe to ride. They've reduced the speed of each train, and that's supposed to also play into the safety. But
Yet they've hired a company to look at all the rails and the bridges because they haven't been inspected either since the dang thing opened, right?
Correct. I think there are, what, 37 bridges or something like that that they need to inspect. That's not exactly comforting.
Yeah. Every car operating on the Blue Line is behind in maintenance, all 42 of them. And the seal on the wheel bearings that caused the derailment of that one train has to be repaired on every axle of every car. So what's the timetable for that? Well, here's what Katz Interim CEO Brent Cagle told WSOC-TV's Hunter Sines.
Right now, our tentative schedule looks like January of 2025 for the whole fleet.
It's going to be a long 2 years, but Cagle assured the Transit Commission,
we will never find ourselves in this situation again.
Brave words. Still, Lee Altman said that she won't feel comfortable that the trains are safe until she hears that from NCDOT, echoing concerns that others have had about whether they can trust Katz to tell us the truth. Brent Cagle is looking to rebuild that trust, but can he trust, I guess is the question. Can he trust the people that he is overseeing?
That's a good question. I mean, when I hear all this culture of silence rhetoric, to me, that's sort of the mistakes were made school of passive rationalization, you know, that somebody shut down honesty and communication in that department. And again, that's what they need to address.
Joe?
I think so. One example of that is the bridge and parking deck inspections. That issue was brought forward by an employee to Brent Cagle. And that's an example of him slowly trying to get these employees to trust him and put everything out into the open.
WBTV's David Hodges again. We should have him on the show, Nick. We did, didn't we? He pointed
I hear
out
he's coming that, back on Tuesday. Stay
that's
tuned.
That's right. David Hodges pointed out something else that we spoke to the mayor about on Wednesday morning. All of this distrust is building at the very time when she and others are pushing for transit expansion and a tax to help pay for it.
how can the city move forward in trying to sell this to voters?
Well, I absolutely have that concern. You heard everyone in this room openly express the concern with public trust. And so if we have to work on that first, that's what we have to do.
Should people feel safe taking the light rail?
I think that people are feeling safe. They're riding it every day.
So you feel safe riding the light rail?
I would certainly ride the light rail.
I was going to leave it at that, but then something else popped up this morning, and it's the perfect definition of irony. If you open up the Oxford Dictionary and want a definition for irony, you will see this sentence in prepping for the... Oh, no, here it is. John Lewis mentioned that when he left last fall, turns out he was looking for a new private opportunity, and he turned out to be working as a consultant for TransPro Consulting, which manages multi-state transit organizations and placement for executives. They bill themselves as leaders in public sector organizational transformation. That's irony. Okay, moving on to our tale of two cities. Huntersville says no, Charlotte says yes. What did Huntersville's town board say no to at Birkdale Village, and why?
The original proposal over at Birkdale was apartments, a conference center, hotel, office space with retail, and parking deck. Residents pushed back. The project was scaled back to just office tower with retail and a 400-space parking deck. And that is what the Huntersville Town Board said no to amid fierce resident pushback.
So was that a surprise that they said no?
It's always a surprise to me when elected officials say no to a developer. In this particular case, though, I feel like if this development was 8 miles south of I-70, down I-77, it would have been approved and Charles City Council could have done it in their sleep. But Huntersville Town Board really listened to the residents who had concerns about building height and traffic and character of Birkdale Village. And they said no, and now the developer has to come back in a year with different plans.
So the two things that you just mentioned that residents were concerned about, building height and additional traffic, were also concerns of residents of Barclay Downs over raising a 50-year-old community of condominiums to be replaced by more than 700 apartments, 24 townhomes and retail in the South Park area. But Charlotte City Council said...
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, that's the answer.
Yes.
Yes, they said yes.
Sorry.
I thought somebody would jump in.
I thought you were cueing a soundbite there.
Right. No.
They said yes. Huntersville Town Board voted 4-2 against. Charlotte City Council was unanimously in favor. And one of the sticking points, I think, at Birkdale Village was the height of the proposed buildings, with one resident worrying that, quote, once buildings are built skyscraper height, it's going to be New York City. The South Park development will also feature buildings taller than average for the area. How tall?
Yeah, you know, what we're not talking about skyscraper height buildings. It's a 7-story building. Let's set that clear. Let's make that clear.
I'm just reading the quote.
I know. It was, and it was in my story too, but you know, it was a 7-story tall building. You know, Charlotte City Council, the way they approach development oftentimes is if they see the developer working in good faith with the residents, not knocks a few stories off of a building, maybe reduces the scope in a couple ways or kicks in more money for affordable housing or other projects, they'll tend to sign off on the projects, even if there are residents opposed.
Okay. So the success of the South Park vote, unanimous, was largely due to some, negotiations that one of the city council members had with the developer and council. Is that correct?
Mark Beccari has been working really hard on this project. And also keep in mind, the condo owners want to sell. So that's a big thing. No, the vast majority of them voted in favor of this. This isn't displacement.
So you have been with us the last several weeks, Nick, to talk about the ongoing saga of the 5-year-old student who was allegedly sexually assaulted on a school bus. The assault was reported to CMS, but the very next day, that child was allegedly forced to sit next to the young boy who allegedly assaulted her. There was another young girl who also reports being sexually assaulted. And you have been trying to get answers. And we heard lengthy segments of your conversation a couple of weeks ago with interim school superintendent, in which she walked out of your interview on camera. So what information were you trying to glean from that conversation?
Well, I want to know what is happening within Charlotte Mecklenburg schools that allows these situations, at the time we just knew about the one, but now we know there are two, to continue being mishandled. Again, as we just alluded to earlier, this was in part, the handling of reported sexual assaults was in part what led to Ernest Winston being fired, a big part of what led to him being fired. And so what has happened at Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools to improve that process? Because we heard from Dr. Hill, the interim superintendent, in January that the process had improved. And then after that, we've now heard these two parents come forward to say, my young daughter, both of them, were sexually assaulted, reported being sexually assaulted at school, and we feel like the process wasn't followed properly, and that's why we're calling you to get help now. And so the basic question for leaders is, why does this keep happening, and what are you going to do about it?
Have you gotten any answers?
No.
Okay. You caught up with CMS Board Chair Elise Dashew in a rather noisy hallway and asked for some answers. We're going to hear a large chunk of that conversation because it's important in order to be fair. You asked her if CMS is protecting students. She responded, we are.
We're protecting students. That is our job. That is why we ran for office.
How is it protecting students to sit 5-year-old girls right next to boys that she reported sexually assaulting her? How does that protect students?
So you are speaking about something that is a confidential matter that we're not permitted to respond about.
If parents can't get answers from you as the board chair, where can parents get answers?
So, again, you know, I know you're going to ask this again and again, and we've been kind of going around doing this dance for a couple of years. And you,
parents have just called us in the last few weeks with new concerns. That's why we're still asking these questions. So again, if parents can't get answers from the chairwoman of the school board, where can they go to get answers about their student safety?
So they should follow the process that the district follows. And there's a very, there's an outlined process for these procedures, and that's happening.
But it's not happening in these cases. That's why they called us.
Well, maybe that's why they called you, or, I mean, I don't know why, what happened between you and some, you know, I don't know, and I can't speak to that either.
Okay, so you asked her how sitting that little girl next to an alleged assailant was protecting students, and she said that she couldn't talk about that. Essentially, it was confidential. She was not allowed to respond to that. What the heck does that mean?
What, earlier in the conversation, and we've posted the full unedited video on our website so people can watch the whole thing. Earlier in the conversation, she tried to cite a federal law called FERPA, which prohibits school districts from handing out confidential student information. The problem with her effort to cite FERPA is that FERPA explicitly doesn't apply to crimes. You can talk about those crimes. You also, the parents or guardians of those students could waive the FERPA rights in a limited capacity to talk about this, which presumably they would do because they called the TV station to talk about it. And the district's never explored any of that, just for 2 years. And we should point out, she lamented that I've been asking her these questions for 2 years. Well, I have been, because people keep calling us for 2 years. And for 2 years, the district has continued to take the same tact of, we can't talk about this. And they use justification that is simply not true.
And she also said in the course of that little clip that we heard that she didn't know why the parents called you for answers. Well, because they're not getting anything from the school.
What she said is offensive to the parents. She said the parents need to follow the process. They called us because they followed the process and got no results. Let's remind everyone that the second 5-year-old girl who reported being sexually assaulted by an older male classmate waiting for the bus, the principal, the assistant principal, according to the documents that we have, the assistant principal knew about it, didn't file a Title IX report, and didn't call the police until after I called to ask them why they didn't do any of those things. So you have the process that totally failed and broke down. So they should follow the process is an insult when her district isn't following their process. And that's why I'm here asking questions that she won't answer.
I don't know whether to call this Kafkaesque or Orwellian. It all harkens back to the same thing we heard just a moment ago in the Katz incident. No one wants to talk about accountability with former leadership. No one wants to talk about failures. They only want to talk about moving forward and ignoring what happened in the past. If these officials really do have their hands tied by law or policy, shouldn't you, the media, and shouldn't parents be fighting for changes in those laws and policy?
Yes, except let's be crystal clear on this, Mike, and I'm glad we're talking about this. Their hands aren't tied. They're the elected leaders of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District. I agree with Elise Dashew that their job is to protect children. We have parents who continue to call us and students who continue to call us to say they're not being protected. And when you ask them why that is, why district personnel didn't do their job, didn't follow federal law, didn't follow school board policies, they say, well, we can't talk about it. They could talk about it, but they choose not to. And I'm going to keep asking questions until someone wants to answer them.
And to be clear, there are some very specified constraints about what they can't say. They could not come out and name children and talk about what was done with these specific children.
No one would ask them to do that.
Say what they did with the bus driver, but they could give a lot more than they're giving.
And you heard it here on the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Meanwhile, CMS is taking steps in the business of education. You reported this weekend that the school board zeroed in on a tough task, helping more students thrive in high school math. I could have used that. So what are they doing?
So this is this ongoing process of zeroing in on the things where they're weakest. And pass rates for Math 1 in high school has been very low. I think they had 4.5% scoring a college and career ready score on that exam when they started. As of midterms this year, they're up to 12.5%, which is up, but their goal is 25% by the end of this next year. Some people thought that was not a very ambitious goal, and they're not on target for that. But some of the things they're doing, training for teachers, they are giving a lot of students an option of, instead of taking this as a one semester class, they take it as a year long class where they're kind of alternating the curriculum and then going back and working on what they need to do. So Crystal Hill says we can get to this goal.
I have a minute left. You mentioned the 4.5%. Now they're at 12%. But when they had 4.5% of high school students ready in math for college, that did not mean, you reported, that 95.5% are unready. So what does it mean?
Well, because the best math students take Math 1 in middle school. So they're just not in that mix. So they're presumably ready and on track. Then you have the students who take that class when they reach ninth grade. And of those, only 4.5% pass. That's still not good.
So more to talk about with regard to education, this time with reading in Fort Mill and how it's being taught there and elsewhere, I guess, in South Carolina. We're going to talk a little bit about the Mecklenburg County revals. Mark Robinson has decided, I think, or will decide shortly to run for governor. And more. There's more on the Local News Roundup. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins, and Doss Helms is with us from WFAE News, along with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, and Katie Peralta Soloff, editor at Axios Charlotte. There's a debate going on at Fort Mill, South Carolina, about how reading is taught there. There is a move to get the system to abandon what some call a discredited reading material and techniques for teaching reading. The A was not needed there. What is this about, Anne?
So this is about this decades-long and very complicated attempt to figure out what's the best way to teach reading. And I think the Fort Mill situation shows how messy it gets, because you have this huge body of research, and then you have companies and individuals that create a curriculum or a set of books and market it and say, this is the research, this is what everybody should be doing. And then you get political. And so in Fort Mill, it is largely the York County Moms for Liberty chapter that has been saying, look, you need to get rid of some of these materials that are based on the outdated techniques, and you need to use the more science of reading oriented stuff. And for some people, you hear Moms for Liberty, and that's all you need to hear. It's bad. But in fact, there's some legitimate questions here.
Well, normally when you hear Moms for Liberty, they want to have certain materials banned or removed from the curriculum or the library. But in this case, they want to teach kids how to read.
Sort of want to ban some of the materials don't like as well.
But much of the debate is being driven by a four-hour podcast called Sold a Story, How Teaching Kids to Read Went So Wrong. This is from American Public Media, a public radio outlet. This is how Fort Mill parent Stephanie Sherrill, who is not a part of the Moms for Liberty, described her reaction to that podcast to the school board.
The podcast, Sold a Story, was my introduction to balanced literacy and my aha moment. Because before now, I kept wondering, why is my child having a hard time reading?
So if they're not teaching children how to read, as she says later in that comment, what are they doing?
Well, actually, the majority of their children are proficient in reading, and Fort Mill, again, is a small and affluent district, majority white. So there's kind of the district says, look, our numbers are pretty darn good. They're well above state averages. And the critics are saying, you've got kids who are walking in the door with a lot of advantages. You're not even reaching all of them. You know, reading challenges are not tied to any one race or demographic. But if you don't have the advantages, you have a bigger challenge. So they are helping some kids read, and the district says we're tailoring it to each individual child. We're giving them what they need. We have a lot of this material that the Moms for Liberty are calling for, and the folks who are looking at it are saying, no, you're really not doing enough.
They're using a method from an American professor named Lucy Calkins, who encourages a process called cueing, and this comes up in that podcast. What is cueing?
It is the idea that if I look at a word and I don't know it, instead of sounding out the letters and figuring out what the word says, that you maybe look at a picture and that'll give you an idea what it is. And you look at the first letter. And again, this goes back to research that was done with children, my contemporaries, when we were like little kids. So it has arguably been greatly misinterpreted. And there is a large school of thought, and it's not just right wing, that those tactics really don't work for a whole lot of kids. They work for some kids, but not most of them.
But it does explain why when we do book authors on this program, if the book doesn't have any pictures, I don't want to do it. South Carolina State Senator Michael Johnson, who is married to a Fort Mill teacher, says he'd like to see the state take a stronger hand in limiting use of the material outlined in that podcast and follow North Carolina's lead and that of Mississippi. And move in a different direction, but that requires extensive training on the, quote, science of reading.
If you're going to move in that direction, what you have to do is spend a lot of money on training. That is the answer. You just can't mandate it and hope that they'll go train themselves.
So where does all of this stand before we move on?
Well, he says it's unlikely that this year there's going to be a push to do. North Carolina allocated $50 million in the 2 years ago session for retraining teachers. I think there will be another large chunk in this biennial session. So he wants to see South Carolina do that, but it's not going to happen right away.
And we have an update, or you have an update, on the situation in Gaston County, where they've had troubles with their payroll system for over a year, which includes people being incorrectly paid or not paid, and their tax records being incorrect and we're approaching tax time. What's the latest?
Well, they did another update, and to be fair, I was not the one that did the reporting on that, but I have watched the meeting, and they say they have 463 folders, which I assume is individuals with unresolved problems. They still have problems getting their state retirement put in a timely manner. They're still having excess deductions pulled from people's paychecks. They very proudly said, we've created a new system for reporting and monitoring problems, and we think it'll be available by the end of April. This, again, is for things that started not this past January, but January a year ago. So it's just painfully slow. And once again, the chief financial officer got out and talked about this, and their superintendent said not a word, which to me is astonishing that they are being sued by their most famous teacher. Bobby Kavnar was National Teacher of the Year. His face was on billboards all over Gaston County. He is suing them along with the North Carolina Association of Educators and a colleague. And their superintendent is talking about the upcoming spring break and school musicals.
It's yet another example, because not just limited to Mecklenburg County, folks, of a complete and total lack of accountability in a government agency.
Could it be that we're just too big now to have amateurs running the place?
Well, these aren't amateurs. I mean, these are people who are paid nice salaries. I mean, school board members are elected, and I don't know how you would do away with that. But they hire people who do these complicated jobs.
Yeah. And they just keep getting better jobs, moving on, moving on, moving on every couple of years. Because you can't give a bad job referral. You can't. You get sued. By now, most Mecklenburg County residents know what their property is valued at because the Mecklenburg County tax assessor has sent out the revaluation starting, I think, on Monday. So we don't have to dwell on this because we're doing a whole show on this on next Monday. But the takeaway is that average residential property valuations are up 58%. Commercial properties declined in value. That's a reverse of what happened the last time this was done in 2019. Why, Katie? Unmute yourself.
Sorry. Yeah. Are you asking why?
Yes. Why the flip? Yes.
So a lot of different factors at play here. I mean, since the last revaluation, we went through the pandemic, and during the pandemic, we also saw a time of really low interest rates. People were buying up homes in a really kind of breakneck pace. In Charlotte, it made for a kind of white hot housing market. I remember those times when houses were on the market for, you know, hours before multiple hours would stack up, before multiple offers would stack up. So that's really driven up prices throughout the county, but from both individual buyers and corporations buying up swaths of land or swaths of properties throughout the region.
And we'll know shortly what the tax bill will be because the county and the city will both use those revals and decide whether to keep the thing revenue neutral or raise taxes or whatever. But taxes play a role in a dispute over a border between Mecklenburg and Union County. There are some folks who think they live in Union County, but in fact, they live in Mecklenburg County.
So my taxes will potentially go up and the value of my house would potentially go down.
That's resident and realtor John DeCristo. Joe, you reported on this. What is this about? Where is this?
Well, first of all, this show, man, this is a high blood pressure show. I got Ajna from today, all the stuff we've been talking about. So it's a nice cool down topic. But yeah.
But hurry.
The meters that Mecklenburg and Union have been using differ from what the state says we should be. And basically, some Union County homeowners should actually be Mecklenburg County residents. The problem is if they correct this, you know, their taxes are going to go up. Their elected officials are going to change. Their schools are going to change. Heck, even who picks up their trash may change.
Yeah.
So the solution was do nothing.
Okay. So that homeowner is concerned about having to pay Mecklenburg County taxes, but Mecklenburg County Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell had a different reaction.
Because over all these years, we could have lost so many thousands of dollars in property taxes. I mean, it's just that it's shocking to me.
And Commissioner Vilma Leek isn't sure she wants Mecklenburg County to absorb these additional homes that may be on our side of the county line.
See, I want an engagement ring first. You got to propose to, got to do the proposal, give me the information, then give me a ring, and then we'll talk about our wedding date.
Huh? What does that mean?
Commissioner Leek wasn't too sure whether she wanted to know what these Union County residents have to offer Mecklenburg County. But
we're only talking about 3.5 houses here, right?
Listen, the solution here, though, that the county commissioners decided was to do nothing, ask the state to establish the borders that already exist and do the least amount of harm here.
So how did this happen in the first place? How did three houses slip across the line?
It's been an issue for decades, and the Union County tax assessor realized that they were going off a different border from the state, brought it to the attention, but both boards do not want things to change.
Okay. Charlotte lost two more titans in the last week. One was from the world of politics, the other from business and philanthropy, Parks Helms and Dale Halton. You may not know Dale, but her name is on a lot of buildings thanks to her generosity. She was the former CEO of Pepsi-Cola Bottling Company, who came to that job at a time when women were a rarity in the C-suite. And in an interview with PBS Charlotte, she talked about the early reaction of the national Pepsi-Cola Company to her appointment in Charlotte.
And when I took over in 82 or 81, whatever it was, there was Joan Zimmerman with Southern Shows.
Bonnie Widenhouse in real estate. And that was really about it. Pepsi came down and threatened to take it away because I was female. And we were meeting with my attorney, and I just looked at him and said, with a nice smile, and said, come on down. We'll do it in my courts here. Never heard any more from them.
Yeah, but we heard a lot from her over the years due to her participation on a lot of boards and her philanthropic efforts, and you will see her names on buildings for years to come. Dale Halton was 85. Meanwhile, Parks Helms passed away last Saturday at the age of 87. He was an attorney, a member of the General Assembly from Mecklenburg for 10 years, sat on the Mecklenburg County Commission for 16 years, and was chair for a while. My remembrance of him is that he was a true Southern gentleman public servant and a progressive who supported LGBT rights before many other politicians in Raleigh. He pushed for the Equal Rights Amendment and a law allowing liquor by the drink, which changed everything in North Carolina, particularly for the restaurant industry. He was on this program last in 2008 to conduct for us a civics class, during which I asked him, given all of his experience at various levels, what level of government he thought had the most impact on our lives.
I would say it's the county commission, and particularly because we're in the human service business. Those are the things that we do. City council is in the hardware business. They build streets and arenas, but we deal with human services.
Quick to pass that off, aren't you?
in a hurry.
Clarify that early, Parks. Good idea.
In a New York minute.
That was right after the city decided to build what is now called Spectrum Center uptown after the voters said no. And you have a fun story, Ann, about Parks Helms. Ann Helms?
I do. People surprisingly seem to think that we were related when I came here, especially if they didn't like what I was reporting. And the two of us both went on a trip when the Chamber of Commerce would sponsor these trips to other cities to see how things were going. They would bring business leaders, political leaders. Peter Gorman had just been hired as superintendent. So I went along and we checked into our hotel in Philadelphia and I got my room key and went in and started unpacking. And I heard some rattling at the door and looked out the peephole, and there was Parks Helms trying to get into his room, which it turned out was our room. Somebody had decided that Parks and Ann Helms must be a couple. So I thought it was hilarious. I called and told them, you know, we're married, but not to each other. And he, you know, he just had such dignity. He did not seem amused when I was telling this story because he didn't want to be associated with anything improprietous.
Yeah, he was a great guy. Parks Helms, we lost him last Saturday at the age of 87, and we should thank him for his efforts on our behalf. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Well, the bankrupt Epicenter, Katie, is getting some new life, a new name, under new ownership. They've made some announcements about new businesses moving in, so fill us in.
Yeah, so this comes several months after a lot of drama at the Epicenter, right? You know, the Epicenter was one of the more notable victims of the pandemic. At one point, the vacancy rate at the Epicenter reached as high as 72%. Most of the kind of well-known places that people know and love there had closed down and it had turned into a bit of a ghost town. So after the property went into receivership, CBRE took over and recently announced plans for kind of a re-envisioning of the property. I had to actually remind myself what the new name is because I keep forgetting. It's Queen City Quarter.
Yeah. Memorable, that is not.
What?
Memorable, not.
We'll see who actually calls it that or just the Epicenter. In my heart, it's always the Epicenter. Yeah. Anyway, CBRE provided an update on a couple of new restaurants and businesses going in, including like a dessert shop, occasion restaurant. There's like an apparel store and some sort of photo op museum. So they'll begin work soon on that.
And finally, if you are a climate change denier, it's becoming more difficult to sing that tune. Just look at what's happening out west with the rain, the snow, the mudslides, the dangerous drought. But you don't have to look that far. Just look outside your front door. Did you notice something? Maybe not, because it's impossible to prove a negative, but we got no snow this winter in Charlotte, not a flake. Weather records go back to 1878 here. They show that Charlotte has never had a winter without a few snowflakes until now. This may be the first time, but not likely the last. The recent average winter temperature here is 4.1 degrees warmer than it was in 1970. Today, it's still March the 24th. predicted to be 84 for a high. Ann Doss Helms, Katie Peralta Soloff, Nick Oxner, Joe Bruno, thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.